The following Dharma talk was recorded in February 2014 in Kansas City, Kansas. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called Awakening with Insight, Cultivating Concentration and Mindfulness, taught by Shyla Catherine and Phil Jones. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Shyla Catherine is the founder of Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. She has practiced meditation since 1980 with more than 8 years of accumulated silent retreat experience. Shyla has authored two books, Focused and Fearless, A Meditator's Guide to States of Deep Joy, Calm, and Clarity, and Wisdom Wide and Deep, A Practical Handbook for Mastering Jhana and Vipassana. Find out more about Shyla at www.imsb.org. Phil Jones has been teaching insight meditation since 1996. He has studied with teachers from Spirit Rock and the Insight Meditation Society, and graduated from the first Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. Phil has served on Mid-America Dharma's Board of Directors since the mid-1990s. Find out more about Phil at www.silentmindopenheart.org.
So tonight I'd like to speak about three kinds of concentration. We've been talking about samadhi on this retreat. Samadhi refers to the calmness and the unification of the mind that is concentrated. In the Visuddhimagga, samadhi is recognized to be too varied to neatly define, and yet it is described as a profitable unification of mind. It takes concentration to allow the mind to rest deeply on any object that we choose for meditation, such as the breath, or in Vipassana practice, the mental and material aspects of the body and the mind. Calmness arises whenever we are not craving for the pleasant or when we are not resisting the unpleasant. When we're steady, equanimous, and not swayed by grasping and resistance. To establish concentration, we must let go of the tendency to desire this and that, the tendency to dwell in the past and to anticipate the future, to indulge in fears and frustrations, expectations and worries, and to entertain ourselves with so many little thoughts. Mind and body can experience a non-discursive, non-distracted, well-settled experience of the present moment. We all know that, at least in little moments. It can be an experience of profound tranquility, marked by the untangling of the mind from all the complexities that seemed to keep us entrapped. Concentration or samadhi uproots the stickiness that feels like we are trapped by the workings of mind. It uproots the stickiness that pulls us into discursive patterns of thought and repeated habitual reactions to feeling. And the mind, when it's free from disturbing thoughts, can rest, can restore itself, can experience profound healing. The three kinds of concentration I want to mention tonight include momentary concentration, in Pali called Kanika Samadhi, neighborhood concentration, in Pali called Upachara Samadhi, and absorptive concentration, in Pali called Apana Samadhi. The level of concentration is determined by the refinement of consciousness as we train the mind to maintain awareness on our meditation object. At each level of concentration, the mind is calm and tranquil. Though the quality of samadhi varies, the nature of the peaceful state is still one of samadhi, of calmness, of tranquility. Momentary concentration, kanaka samadhi, describes a mind that is unified in its perception of objects as they change moment by moment. It's a concentration that arises through a continuity of mindfulness. And usually that mindfulness is mindful of changing sensations in the body and changing perceptions in the mind. The mind could be thought to be momentarily collected. And then in the next moment, collected again on the next perception, and then the next perception, and then the next perception, as we perceive the flow of impermanent, changing phenomena. The mind still moves. It moves from hearing to seeing to touching to feeling this, that, and the other. So it's thought that it wanders in this sense to various objects of perception. But it remains within a concentrated state. So the mind is not wandering to thoughts that agitate the mind. The content of the thought is entirely wholesome. Ajahn Chah compares kanaka samadhi to taking a walk, resting, walking, and then resting again, because the journey is periodically interrupted. And yet, the journey is essentially undisturbed, because even though we stop and rest for a moment, in a short time, we continue again. Neighborhood concentration, or access to jhana, upachara samadhi, might, strictly speaking, refer only to three mind moments in a jhana cognitive process, those three mind moments that precede the actual jhana impulsion consciousness moments. Those three moments that precede the impulsion consciousness moments are called access mind moment, change of lineage mind moment, and the conformity consciousness mind moment. But beyond the technical details of Abhidhamma analysis of jhana cognitive processes, the term upachara samadhi is widely and generally used to refer to states where the attention is steady. The mind is bright. The hindrances are absent. The state of mind is relatively blissful, or at least ease-filled. And the attention is well settled upon its meditation object. There's no distraction. It's as though we're on the threshold to absorption, or in the neighborhood of that deep absorptive concentration, but not yet in it. This strong and undistracted concentration develops out of firm a concentration on a single object. Ajahn Chah compares upachara samadhi to wandering about inside your own home. Attention doesn't stray from the meditation object, and yet thinking may still arise, but it circles only around the meditation object. There may be some movement of mind, some thought of adjusting the effort, some thought about the quality of mind that is knowing the meditation object. Because the seclusion that is characteristic of absorption and jhana has not yet arisen, the thought can arise. But the calm tranquility will prevent the mind from wandering off to any subject other than its meditation subject. So the thoughts might include simple things like, maybe I need a little bit more energy here. Or can I refresh the interest in the meditation object? Or pondering perhaps the characteristics of the meditation object. or the quality of the samadhi itself, the quality of the mind. Hindrances at this point will not be arising, and so nothing is there to pull the attention away from the meditation object. There's no judgment, there's no aversion, there's no doubt or conceit, there's no comparing or craving or sensual desire. There's no stories about what I will do, what I want, what I have done, what I plan for, and there's no dullness of mind. The few thoughts that arise are entirely wholesome and focused exclusively on the meditation object and the meditation practice. I referred the other day to a quote from the Middling Discourses where the Buddha said, "If I think and ponder upon thoughts of letting go, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. It is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind and concentrated it so that it would not be disturbed." It's an interesting moment when we experience this deep concentration in the vicinity of or in the neighborhood of absorption. But there is an interesting transition that can occur when absorption occurs. When we enter Apana Samadhi, then we find the mind becomes utterly still, one-pointed, and unified with the object. The mind becomes secluded from sensory experiences. So even if there are sounds that are present, we're not really going to be hearing them. Even though the body is touching the seat or the floor or the cushion, we're not really feeling it. The mind is just simply absorbed in the perception of the meditation object. And these sensory contacts do not disturb the tranquility of this simple, repeated perception of the meditation object. It's as if we don't hear anything or don't feel anything, even though the body and the mind are functioning. There's just no reaction to the sensory encounters because consciousness is so absorbed with its meditation object that it's not engaging in any sense or cognitive process. Apana Samadhi, therefore, can be sustained for very long periods of time. It's deeply peaceful. But when one finally withdraws from this state of Apana Samadhi, the perceptions of the body will arise again. We'll experience sensory perceptions. Attention will again meet the changing nature of body and mind. It's a powerful moment, actually, for insight, as the concentrated attention meets the nature of the physical and the mental, the psychophysical process, or in the classic language, the five aggregates affected by clinging. One might approach this body by perceiving it in various ways. How do we see the body? Often we'll see it in normal daily life as my body, but a concentrated mind isn't going to see it as my body. When we perceive the body, we might see its characteristics as impermanent. We might see hardness and pressure as wind element and earth element that are impermanent and changing. We might see the unattractive nature of the body, the asubha, not beautiful characteristic. Or we might have insight into emptiness or the absence of inherent existence, that not self perception might arise. Or in one way or another, when we emerge from absorption, we are going to encounter the senses. We might experience them more in terms of the sensory encounter in the body or the quality of the mind that is knowing it, the mental experience. And in all of it, we will see it very clearly, usually perceiving impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, or the not self characteristic, and perhaps sometimes the not beautiful or asubha characteristic. Due to the depth of the concentration, these insights, which are the primary insights of insight meditation, have a powerful and a liberating impact on the mind. They penetrate our consciousness at a very deep level, deeper than any analytical or discursive understanding could bring. The clarity of calm and insight gives rise to a sequence of experiences of disenchantment and dispassion toward mental and material attachments. We see the transparent nature of what we call self and stop clinging to this material and mental process that we habitually imagine to be me or mine. The effect of the concentrated mind meeting the reality of changing experience is transformative, because the insight is powered by the still and calm mind. Such penetrating insight can liberate the mind from deeply ingrained habitual tendencies, craving, clinging, attachment, ignorance. And the understandings that arise from a concentrated mind are firm and unshakable. Now, it's true that concentration develops most easily in rather protected conditions. That's why we go on silent retreats. The conditions for cultivating concentration include setting aside the entanglements of our busy lives, putting aside our work responsibilities and our family duties and all the stuff that keeps stimulating our identities, just setting them aside for 10 days. The world will be fine if we're not upholding all those things for 10 days. And then we enter into retreat to establish an inner solitude and an inward quality of attention, where we can develop a purity of mind that brings gladness to the mind. We might use a variety of techniques. We might count the breaths. We might focus very, very closely on the breath. We might use colors or elements, parts of the body, as our meditation object. We might explore loving kindness or the Brahmaviharas as the meditation object. Or we might just basically make the commitment to diligently return to the breath every single time we wander off. For jhana practice, the breath is the favored object, partly because it's a relatively neutral perception, not extremely pleasant or extremely unpleasant for most people. It's relatively neutral. It can be felt as a tangible sensation, or it can be perceived as a concept. It's related to the bodily processes, but it's known as present moment experience. It has the capacity to become highly refined. And although it is related to the body, it can be known directly by the mind. This practice that we've undertaken here is called Anapanasati Samadhi, or concentration due to mindfulness with breathing. And it has the potential to lead the mind through all four states of jhana. But it isn't only meditation practice and retreat conditions that support the development of concentration. The Visuddhimagga very helpfully lists 11 conditions for the development of concentration. The first one is cleanliness. This can include personal hygiene. It can include keeping our living quarters tidy and not having a mess around our lives. You probably know how much easier and calmer things are when your desk is clean, and how agitated it can be when it's overflowing with stuff and you can't find anything. Well, that's a worldly example, but similar with the mind, similar with our experiences. Hygiene is kind of a funny one, but, you know, imagine if you really didn't shower for a long time. You might sit here being distracted, smelling that. Ooh, what is that smell? Oh, it's me. It could be distracting. The second suggestion is to balance the mind. And what do we balance? We balance the five controlling faculties. In particular, we balance faith and wisdom. We balance energy with concentration. Now, balancing energy with concentration probably is fairly obvious to you at this point, because you may have noticed that if you get too concentrated, too calm, and too focused, you fall asleep. But if you're too energetic and too gung-ho, you're restless. We need to have enough energy to support the concentration and enough calmness to settle the energy. So we balance energy and concentration. Now, the wisdom and the faith might not be as obvious, but you can imagine that if we were only had faith with no wisdom, it would easily be, we'd be gullible, we'd slide into blind belief. We wouldn't be discerning. But if we only had wisdom and no faith, the excessive criticality of the discerning mind might prevent us from ever just trying, just seeing for ourselves, because we'd be leaping ahead to trying to understand and figure it out and measure it and sort it and discriminate it. And so we need a balance, some faith and some wisdom. And these two faculties inform each other. As we develop the faith and the trust to go into an experience, we have the experience, and then we wisely reflect upon it and develop a deeper understanding of what the nature of that experience is. That wisdom usually reinforces our faith. That actually, that state of samadhi was indeed a wholesome state. There was nothing to fear. So it reinforces the faith, lets us go a little bit deeper. And then we reflect, what was that? Was that still okay? And we understand that that was also a wholesome state, and we go a little bit deeper. So we don't just plow through with blind belief and faith that everything that we hear in the spiritual tradition must be true. And we don't just follow the advice of our teachers blindly without reflection. But we take the instructions with enough faith to try them. And then we reflect and go back and forth. Sometimes I've had people with a lot of brain power, wisdom power, criticism power, want instruction. But every instruction that I give, they counter it with some comparison to something else. Compare it to a different teacher or a different quote or a different sutta. And there's so many different things that can be compared and argued and debated that there's no time left to meditate after that. So sometimes we just have to take an instruction and have the faith to put it into practice just a little bit and then reflect. So this balancing of the controlling faculties of faith and wisdom, of energy and concentration, is very important. The fifth of the controlling faculties is mindfulness, and that's inherently balanced. And that helps to balance everything. The third factor that helps to develop concentration is to choose a clear object for concentration. I think at this point in the retreat, most of you have a pretty clear sense of how you're approaching your meditation. It isn't so much that there's one right way to do it. I really think there are a variety of valid approaches to the development of Anapanasati Samadhi. But I don't think we should in every sitting switch between all these valid approaches. We have to pick something and to develop it, and not just change our path every time it becomes a little bit difficult. In every approach, we have to go through the difficulties, and every approach requires that we go through the difficulties for that approach to mature. The fourth factor is to learn to uplift the discouraged mind. Sometimes we get discouraged. It's inevitable. Sometimes we're discouraged because we just endured a multiple hindrance attack on the sixth day of a retreat, and we wondered, where did that come from? I was doing so good. And we feel discouraged. Well, that's what it was, a multiple hindrance attack. Okay, fine. Pick ourselves up, lift ourselves up, and continue on. Sometimes we're discouraged because we thought we'd be better, we'd be further along than this. Or we remember how we left our last retreat, and we think, oh, I thought I was going to pick up there and keep going forward, and I haven't hardly even gotten there yet. All kinds of comparisons can be very discouraging for the mind. So we have to learn to uplift the mind if it starts to feel discouraged. We also need to calm the overenthusiastic mind, because sometimes, instead of discouragement, things start to come together, and it's like, whoa, this is what she's talking about. And we are really happy. So happy we want to rush out and get an interview, we want to tell somebody, or we want to just like dance and sing. But this kind of enthusiasm will dissipate the concentration and the collectedness of mind that we have worked so hard to attain. It's very important to be able to compose the mind rather than let it get enthusiastic. We have to allow the space for joy. But it's a quiet joy. It's a contained joy. So that the joy and delight and rapture that arise as the mind lets go of the hindrances, then we'll feel joy, we'll feel light. But we have to let it suffuse the meditation object, draw it in to continue to further this practice. We can't let it get the mind too enthusiastic. We have to calm it down. We also have to learn to cheer the mind that's withered by pain, because, you know, these are long sittings and sometimes the body aches. In all ways, we develop a continuously balanced awareness to watch the mind as we move about the building, as we move from sitting to walking, as we go through the dining room, to maintain a balanced, composed, non-reactive stance toward all things. Maybe the chili was a little spicy. Maybe the soup had a vegetable in it you didn't like. Maybe whatever. If something arises and it is what it is, watch the mind so that it doesn't get reactive, and maintain a sense of coming back to balance anytime the mind starts to go into a judgmental or a reactive stance. Come back into balance. The eighth and the ninth are to avoid distracted friends and to seek the company of focused friends. We actually are influenced by other people. I mean, parents know that. They know that the kids that their kids hang out with have an effect on them. And adults like to think we're immune from that. Like we can hang out with anybody and we're not going to be affected. But it's not true. We are social beings and we are affected by each other. And I think in many ways we provide a remarkable container of support when we come on retreats to offer our presence to each other in the silence and to create a community for these 10 days of focused friends. The Visuddhimagga also suggests that we reflect on the peace of absorption. We have to want it. We have to consider it peaceful, interesting, something that will elevate us, will support our path, will lead onward to awakening, to sense the peace that's possible, to reflect on that potential. And then finally, the last suggestion is to intentionally incline the mind toward developing concentration. We might need to clarify our intention at the beginning of the sitting, to actually be clear how we're going to direct the mind and what we're doing, why we're doing it, what we want at the beginning of each sitting. We just have to want to be focused. Concentration states are impermanent. No matter what degree of concentration you've attained, great or small, it's going to dissipate at the end of the retreat because the conditions that were supporting the concentration here are going to change. And yet, the insights that arise, the understanding that comes through this practice of concentration and insight will not dissipate. The state may change. The feeling quality of it may change. But what we learn about the mind and what we learn about the world and this world of mind and body, how we encounter the senses, can be radically changed with deep insight. Many people wonder if it's worth developing concentration on a retreat simply because it only lasts while you're on retreat. So what's the point? What's the point? Sometimes as we start to approach the end of the retreat, people will ask, well, how can I do this at home? How can I integrate it? Can I go to work in jhana? Can I drive in a samadhi state? No, of course not. But that's not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to create some kind of spiritual state like a little bubble that we live in. It's true that sometimes there is a bit of a transition that's needed to integrate our experiences from a retreat into our daily life. But this is the case with insight retreats just as much as concentration-oriented practice. But there's nothing to worry about. There's nothing to be concerned about in this. Developing concentration, I believe, is a very worthy commitment. However, the attainments that we experience, the particular jhana absorptions that we might experience, is really in the category of might experience. It's not guaranteed. It doesn't happen for everyone. In fact, it doesn't happen for most people. That doesn't make the practice less important. It just means we have to keep the practice in perspective. Jhana is repeatedly described in the sutta, in the Buddhist tradition, as being rare, very rare. Because even if you do everything right, you can't make absorption happen. You can't force the mind into a secluded state. Jhanas arise when the causes and conditions ripen And we all know that causes and conditions are beyond our control. And so we simply try the best we can with the moment of experience that we have moment by moment. We incline towards concentration. We let go of expectations, judgments, comparisons. We abandon any timeline that we have that demands success by a certain sitting or by a certain day or by a certain retreat or by a certain decade. One of the great values that I see in undertaking the concentration and jhana practices is simply that this approach to practice is a brilliant way of refining very practical meditative skills. It's a good, strong practice, isn't it? We have to be diligent. There's a lot we have to renounce. We develop clarity regarding our object. We're always balancing our effort, cultivating a keen interest in the moment, in the object, in what's actually happening. And along the way, we have to work with and abandon all the hindrances. Good practice. Really good, solid practice. The fundamentals are all here. And this isn't small stuff. But some people misunderstand the purpose of concentration practice and make the mistake to think it's about the attainments rather than the skills. That the practice will only be successful if I get into jhana, if I can walk out of this retreat and say, I attained the state. See, I have this badge or I have this certificate. But that's not what it's about. If we focus on what we want to get out of the practice or who we want to become by doing it, then we are actually developing the defilements of conceit and craving and arrogance rather than abandoning them. Chronic expectation or the constant assessing of our achievements simply reinforces the concept of self through identification with success and failure. These are the very defilements that we need to overcome in practice, not feed. But these defilements are not created by jhana practice. They're not even unique to jhana practice. Approaching any meditation practice with the desire to gain predictable experiences or confirm personal accomplishments or attain special states will corrupt the potential of meditation. But the potential of meditation is profound. It can lead to deep calm, clarity, and liberation. Any focus on the minor personal achievements has the danger of enhancing the arrogance when they're attained or creating desire or doubt, which can be quite debilitating when they're not attained. Comparisons, expectations, conceit, these are the poisons that prevent genuine release, the genuine release that is needed for deeply absorbed states of concentration and the genuine release of the fetters that describe the awakened mind. Both jhana and vipassana are practiced together. They are not separate paths. Calm informs insight and insight informs tranquility. But until we have some degree of insight, particularly into the emptiness of self, the mind will almost inevitably pick up its accomplishments as fodder to embellish the me and my story. We might be willing to let go a little bit, but this practice demands that we release all attachments. We must be patient with our process. We must practice patiently, inclining towards balance, inclining towards equanimity, inclining towards release and relinquishment at every step of the training. We must practice patiently, practice concentration and insight patiently, patiently relinquishing all attachments. And then little by little, unwholesome states will be weakened and abandoned, and gradually wholesome states will be cultivated and strengthened. We might not see the progress in every meditation session. We might not see the progress from one day to the next. We might not see the progress from one retreat to the next. We might not see progress in a way that we can easily measure or quantify. It might not show up on brain scans or surveys. But we will know the trajectory and the development of our own minds for ourselves. What is the state of your mind on most days? Most of the time in your life? And what is the state of your mind right now? You may have read a book about the life of a great teacher named Dipama. The book was first printed with the title Knee Deep in Grace, edited and written by or compiled or written or edited, I'm not sure, biography by Amy Schmidt. And in this book, Amy writes, Dipama did not say that the mind is mostly stories. She said that there is nothing in the mind but stories. These are the personal dramas that create and maintain the sense of individual identity, who we are, what we do, what we are and are not capable of. Without our being aware of it, the endless series of such thoughts drives and limits our life, and yet those stories are without substance. Do you think your mind is all stories in your daily life, your day-to-day, the last couple of hours? And then I want to read a little bit more from this Dipama book because it was very interesting. It says, Dipama challenged students' belief in their stories, their attachment to the stories. When someone said, I can't do that, she would ask, are you sure? Or who says? Or why not? She encouraged students to observe the stories, to see their emptiness, and to go beyond the limitations they impose. Let go of thinking, she urged. Meditation is not about thinking. At the same time, Dipama taught that the mind is not an enemy to be gotten rid of. Rather, in the process of befriending the mind, in getting to know and accept it, it ceases to be a problem. Dipama knew the freedom that follows that process. She lived in a state of thought-free awareness. In a group interview, somebody innocently asked, "What is it like in your mind?" And Dipama smiled, closed her eyes, and quietly answered, "In my mind, there are three things: concentration, loving kindness, and peace." Not sure if he had heard correctly, the student asked, "Is that all?" And Dipama replied, "Yes, that is all." I'll end here as we ponder a mind whose natural and usual state is characterized by concentration, loving kindness, and peace, because this is the result of deep practice.